And we continue our newspaper coverage on this Friday, the 20th of February, 2026, with today's Boston Herald. We say hello today to Dottie and Joan.
Thank you, John. We'll start with one of the articles from today's Herald's front page. Academy troopers suspended with pay, by Rick Sobey. The four stateies facing charges over the death of trooper trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia will be suspended with pay, Mass State Police has announced. Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, Trooper Edwin Rodriguez, Trooper David Montañez, and Trooper Casey Lamont will get to keep their salary as they face involuntary manslaughter and other charges in connection with the recruit's boxing death. Penton has an annual pay rate of $141,807. Rodriguez and Montañez both have yearly rates of $100,486. And Lamont has an annual salary of $105,510. In accordance with Article 6 of its rules and regulations, the Massachusetts State Police convened duty status hearings to determine the duty status of the four members who will face criminal charges as a result of the independent investigation into Trooper Enrique Delgado's death, Mass State Police said in a statement yesterday. The department reviewed all available information and determined the four individuals will be suspended with pay, the state police added. As in any disciplinary process, should additional information become available to the department through the judicial process, it may convene a subsequent duty status hearing to evaluate the new information. The four troopers attached to the Massachusetts State Police Academy will face involuntary manslaughter charges and also charges for causing serious bodily injury while participating in a training program involving physical exercise, according to the Attorney General's office. Penton is also facing a charge of perjury. The charges were announced last week at a press conference between Attorney General Andrea Campbell and Attorney David Meyer, who was hired to complete an independent investigation into Delgado Garcia's death. The four members of the state police were part of the Academy's Defense Tactics Unit. Delgado Garcia was knocked unconscious during a boxing exercise at the State Police Academy on September 12, 2024, and died the following day. During the press conference, Meyer said Delgado Garcia had been exhibiting concussion symptoms from a boxing match the day before he was knocked out, that is, September 11th. Reckless conduct resulted in Enrique Delgado Garcia suffering concussion-like symptoms as the result of unauthorized, unapproved, and unsupervised boxing-related sparring exercises that occurred during the academy training activities, Meyer added. Penton, the supervisor of the unit, will also face a perjury charge for allegedly providing false statements to a grand jury about when she initially knew of Delgado Garcia's concussion symptoms. A special statewide grand jury indicted the state police officers, who have not been arrested, but will be issued summons to be arraigned at a later date. The grand jury heard from 150 witnesses, the vast majority state police officers, and examined 350 exhibits. While the grand jury evidence concluded with charges for the four officers, it did not show that charges should be brought against the Academy's command staff, Meyer said. There is no evidence that Enrique Delgado Garcia was targeted in any way, he added. There is no evidence that anyone, Academy staff, fellow trainees, or any others, harbored any personal animosity towards Enrique Delgado Garcia. Campbell had appointed Meyer as an independent investigator because of a conflict of interest within the Worcester County District Attorney's Office. Delgado Garcia began his career in public service as a witness advocate for the office. State Police Colonel Jeffrey Noble has noted that Mass State Police has taken steps to reform the agency since the trooper trainee's death, including initiating an independent review by the International Association of Chiefs of Police and expanding supports for recruits. Howdy.
And now, another front page story. Randy Andy and other Epstein thoughts from Howie Carr. Randy Andy, an Epstein file court jester. Now it can be told. I'm in the Epstein files, but really, it's no big deal. Yeah, I know you've heard that one before, many times. But in this case anyway, it really isn't a big deal. And you can trust me. I'm not like the others. When the Department of Justice, DOJ, released the millions of pages in the Epstein files, Congress wisely ordered them to include a search engine for names, any names. It's the first time the DOJ has ever had a web page where you must be 18 years old to access it. But you can understand why. I didn't even check my own name, but somebody I know did, and sure enough, there I was. A single mention couldn't be any smaller than a footnote. But my name is there, on July 10th, 2020, included in something headlined FBI Public Affairs Director's AM News Briefing. Wait a second. Hadn't Epstein already committed suicide a year earlier? Why is that briefing even included? It concerned an interview I had done the previous day, probably on Newsmax. Acting DHS Secretary Wolf said on the Howie Carr Show, 7-9, that there is a lack of political leadership in a number of cities, to include Portland, but we have seen it in Seattle. We have seen it in Atlanta and Chicago and elsewhere. Not providing that backup, leadership, at least allowing their police department to do their job. The more things change, I don't even remember the interview. I had to look up the acting secretary's first name, Chad. But now you know, full disclosure and all that. In public relations, it's accepted practice that if you have something you'd like to get out very quietly on your own underplayed terms so that no one can ever accuse you of covering it up. Just wait until a bigger news story drops. Then push your little black eye out there. It'll get buried and no one will notice it. That's exactly what Tony Blair, UK's government, did on 9/11. A flack even put out an email to all the British departments suggesting just such a tactic. So the big news yesterday was Andrew, formerly known as Prince Andrew, being arrested in England for his role in the Epstein scandal. No, not involving anything serious, like underage girls. Randy Andy is apparently charged only with giving Epstein, I quote, trade documents. Seriously, who would give that clown any important, classified, anything. This rap is like nailing Al Capone on income tax evasion. But not for the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Still, as long as I'm working on a proffer deal here, telling all about my back pages, here's some more info to file under famous people I have known. I once had my photo taken with Randy Andy's ex, Fergie. It was at Ernie Bach Jr.'s estate in Norwood in 2018. I seem to recall. Too bad I can't find the actual photo. And us together. But that's me. Waiting in line for my turn. So, it's all out there now. Can I get a CWOF? Continued without a finding. There's a lot of innocuous but embarrassing stuff in those Epstein files. For instance, if you type in Bill Weld, you are directed to some chatter in 2010 between Epstein and Peter Mandelson, the gay Labour Party power broker in Britain, just forced out of polite society by the latest revelations. Weld's name comes up, and somebody else whose name is redacted asks either Epstein or Mandelson, what's Bill Weld like? Influential? Serious? If they'd asked me, I'd have answered neither. Not this century, anyway. The fact is, though, that the Epstein files haven't panned out for the Democrats the way they were hoping. Who ultimately cares about some inbred nitwit like Randy Andy? The Democrats were hunting big game, and the biggest game of all. The Democrats... Excuse me. But now it comes to Donald Trump. There is no there. If the Democrats had anything on Trump in the files, they had 4 years during the Biden catastrophe to drag the scandals out into the open and end his political career once and for all. If Trump's so damn guilty, why didn't they lug him in 2021 to 25? It's such an obvious question that even a fluffer on MSDNC had to ask it this week of the Groucho Marx lookalike, Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland. So, Raskin stammered, you have to go and look specifically at particular prosecutorial decisions. And what was taking place in terms of the other cases? So I don't know. We could try to reconstruct that record. But the point is that Donald Trump is the one who has led the crusade to say that Epstein, who was his very close friend, and so on. Stop me if you've heard this blather before. About a million times, in fact. The Democrats asked for this. Ask and ye shall receive. They demanded that the files be released. Complete. with a search engine for names. Now, they have been, and the Democrats are claiming, Trump just wanted to muddy the waters. Next time, Democrats, be careful what you wish for. Joan?
Thank you, Dottie. Lamar Cook Wasn't Working Alone by Colleen Cronin. Ex-governor's aide indicted. The grand jury indictment of Lamar Cook suggested for the first time that the former Healey administration official wasn't working alone on an alleged drug trafficking scheme that involved moving 21 kilos of cocaine through public buildings, including the UMass campus hotel. Cook faces charges of trafficking more than 200 grams of cocaine, conspiracy to violate drug law, possessing a firearm and ammunition without an FID card, and operating a vehicle unlicensed, according to Hampton County Superior Court documents that were handed down by the grand jury on February 3rd. The Western Mass ex-aide to Governor Maura Healey had faced similar charges in district court, which he pleaded not guilty to. But the indictment includes an additional charge of conspiracy to violate controlled substance laws with an unnamed John Doe. The document does not specify the anonymous co-conspirator's exact involvement in the alleged crime, or whether he will be a witness in the case or co-defendant. Previously, a prosecutor in the case told the Herald earlier this year that they were interested in the question of where the drugs in the case were going, but the investigation was still open. Cook was arrested in October after prosecutors say he funneled packages of cocaine under fake names to Hotel UMass, where Cook used to work, and then to a state office in Springfield. Federal authorities had intercepted some of the packages before they reached Massachusetts and notified the state police that they contained large quantities of cocaine, according to court records reviewed by the Herald. Law enforcement set up surveillance on the packages sent to Hotel UMass, and an officer posed as a UPS driver to deliver the package to the state office building where Cook worked as Healey's deputy director of Western Mass. The controlled delivery occurred on a Saturday, and police said that Cook had let the building's security know that he was expecting a package during the weekend and to call him. When the undercover officer arrived at the building, security put him in touch via phone with Cook, who allegedly told the officer the package was his. And an admission Cook backed off of once he arrived at the building. A warrant was issued for Cook's arrest on October 28th, and he's been in custody ever since. A judge held Cook on $75,000 bail for the trafficking charge, something his defense has tried to lower twice without success. The sum is not just something you just pony up, his attorney Kedar Ismail said after a failed bail review in January, explaining that Cook's family has been trying to raise the funds to get the defendant released. At the same time, Healey's office has been trying to claw back money the state mistakenly paid out to Cook for unused sick and vacation time. The government accidentally paid Cook $31,000, even though he had been fired for cause. When the state tried to reverse the direct deposit to Cook's account, it bounced because it had insufficient funds. As of now, the money has not yet been paid back. Cook will have another opportunity to review his bail now that the case is at the Superior Court. He is expected to be arraigned on March 6th. Healey to skip Trump's dinner with governors by Tim Dunn. Maura Healey says that she will not be attending President Trump's White House meeting on Friday and Saturday dinner with governors from across the United States, calling the event a farce and a waste of time. The governor criticized Trump for implementing changes in the annual meeting and dinner this year, changing the venue location to the White House, and making himself the host. The National Governors Association has traditionally hosted the annual conference. For years, governors of both parties met with presidents of both parties annually. This has always been an important opportunity for us to discuss the most pressing issues facing our country and how we can work together on solutions, Healey said in a Thursday press release. But it should come as no surprise to anyone that President Trump has completely politicized this. He continues to act in a manner that's beneath the dignity of the office of President of the United States. Healey joins a group of Democratic governors from across the country skipping out on Trump's weekend meeting and dinner after he had at first only invited Republican governors and then extended the invitation out to all Democratic governors, with the exception of Democratic Colorado Governor Jared Polis and Maryland Governor Wes Moore. Healey will be in Washington, D.C. this weekend, however, with plans to participate in a main stage affordability policy discussion with Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear and Republican Montana Governor Greg Gianforte on Saturday morning. Donna?
Thank you, Joan. And now a word from the Herald opinion page. The editorial. Welfare dollars are being wasted. All too frequently, government programs for sympathetic causes are plagued by the high levels of fraud. Consider Minnesota. Thieves systematically ripped off programs to feed children, provide housing and child care, and help children with autism. Federal prosecutors believe the amount stolen could top $9 billion. Prosecutors have already secured more than 6 convictions. The conflict over immigration enforcement drove this story from the headlines, but it remains a massive scandal. After this story received public scrutiny, the Trump administration moved to freeze more than $10 billion for social service programs in several blue states, including California, Colorado, Illinois, Minnesota, and New York. The targeted programs included the Child Care Development Fund, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF program, and the Social Services Block Grant program. The effort is currently tied up in federal court. Unfortunately, for taxpayers, they aren't only being ripped off in Democrat-run states. As the Wall Street Journal recently reported, many states have used TANF money for a variety of questionable expenditures. Audits have shown a range of problems, including states inaccurately reporting large expenditures and disbursing millions of dollars to contractors without tracking how the cash was spent, the journal states. State and federal records show red and blue states alike have directed hundreds of millions of dollars to programs with tenuous or no connections to TANF SCOLE. It wasn't supposed to be like this. In 1996, President Bill Clinton and Republicans, including House Speaker Newt Gingrich, worked to revamp welfare. Instead of paying people directly, the federal government sent money to the states as block grants. The theory was that states would be better positioned to spend the money. Clinton called it, I quote, ending welfare as we know it, end of quote. In some ways, that has been true. The number of families receiving a direct financial stipend from TANF fell from more than 2.5 million in 1999 to under 1 million in recent years. But there have been many examples of states using their financial flexibility to plug budget holes or fund pet projects, not help needy families. The federal government has been lax in requiring states to live up to standards the law already put in place. Hayden Dubloy with the Foundation for Government Accountability estimates 1 in 5 TANF dollars, or about $6 billion, is misspent every year, the journal reported. Good intentions aren't enough. The federal government needs to implement and enforce more safeguards to ensure that the money spent on this program and others is used as intended, rather than lining the pockets of fraudsters and scammers. The American taxpayer deserves no less. Joan?
Trump warns of bad things if Iran doesn't make a deal. By John Gambrell of the Associated Press. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Iran held annual military drills with Russia on Thursday as a second American aircraft carrier drew closer to the Middle East, with both the United States and Iran signaling they are prepared for war if talks on Tehran's nuclear program fizzle out. President Donald Trump said he believes 10 to 15 days is enough time for Iran to reach a deal. But the talks have been deadlocked for years, and Iran has refused to discuss wider U.S. and Israeli demands that it scale back its missile program and sever ties to armed groups. Indirect talks held in recent weeks made little visible progress, and one or both sides could be buying time for final war preparations. Iran's theocracy is more vulnerable than ever, following 12 days of Israeli and U.S. strikes on its nuclear sites and military last year, as well as mass protests in January that were violently suppressed. In a letter to the U.N. Security Council on Thursday, Amir Saeed Iravani, the Iranian ambassador to the U.N., said that while Iran does not seek tension or war and will not initiate a war, any U.S. aggression will be responded to decisively and proportionately. In such circumstances, all bases, facilities, and assets of the hostile force in the region would constitute legitimate targets in the context of Iran's defensive response, Iravani said. Earlier this week, Iran launched a drill that involved live fire in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow opening of the Persian Gulf through which a fifth of the world's traded oil passes. Tensions are also rising inside Iran as mourners hold ceremonies honoring slain protesters 40 days after their killing by security forces. Some gatherings have seen anti-government chants despite threats from authorities. The movements of additional American warships and airplanes, with the USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier near the mouth of the Mediterranean, don't guarantee a U.S. strike on Iran, but it bolsters Trump's ability to carry out one should he choose to do so. He has so far held off on striking Iran after setting red lines over the killing of peaceful protesters and mass executions, while re-engaging in nuclear talks that were disrupted by the war in June. Iran has agreed to draw up a written proposal to address U.S. concerns raised during this week's indirect nuclear talks in Geneva. According to a senior U.S. official who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. The official said top national security officials gathered Wednesday to discuss Iran and were briefed that the, quote, full forces needed to carry out potential military action are expected to be in place by mid-March. The official did not provide a timeline for when Iran is expected to deliver its written response. It's proven to be, over the years, not easy to make a meaningful deal with Iran, and we have to make a meaningful deal. Otherwise, bad things happen, Trump said Thursday. Later, while answering questions from reporters, Trump said Iran has 10 to 15 days to reach a deal. I would think that would be enough time, he said. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk urged his nation's citizens to immediately leave Iran as within a few dozen or even a few dozen hours. The possibility of evacuation will be out of the question. He did not elaborate, and the Polish embassy in Tehran did not appear to be drawing down its staff. The German military said that it had moved a mid-two-digit number of non-commissioned critical personnel out of a base in northern Iraq because of the current situation in the region, and in line with its partners' actions. It said that some troops remain to help keep the multinational camp running in Erbil, where they train Iraqi forces. This week, another 50 U.S. combat aircraft, F-35s, F-22s, and F-16s, were ordered to the region, supplementing the hundreds deployed to bases in the Arab Gulf states. The New York-based Soufan Center think tank wrote, the deployments reinforce Trump's threat, restated on a nearly daily basis, to proceed with a major air and missile campaign on the regime if talks fail.
Thanks, Joan. Former Prince Andrew arrested on suspicion of misconduct by Danica Kirka. From the Associated Press. This is out of London. The former Prince Andrew was arrested and held for hours by British police Thursday on suspicion of misconduct in public office related to his links to Jeffrey Epstein, an extraordinary move in a country where authorities once sought to shield the royal family from embarrassment. It was the first time in nearly four centuries that a senior British royal was placed under arrest, and it underscored how deference to the monarchy has eroded in recent years. King Charles III, whose late mother lived by the motto, I quote, never complain, never explain, end of quote, took the unusual step of issuing a statement on the arrest of his brother, now known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course, the king said. As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter. The Thames Valley Police Force said Mountbatten Windsor was released Thursday evening, about 11 hours after he was detained at his home in eastern England. He was photographed in a car leaving the police station near the Royal Sandringham Estate. Police said he was released under investigation, meaning he has neither been charged nor exonerated. The police force, which covers areas west of London, including Mountbatten, Windsor's former home, said Thursday that a man in his 60s from Norfolk had been arrested and was in custody. Police did not identify the subject, in line with standard procedures in Britain. Mountbatten Windsor, 66, moved to the King's private estate in Norfolk after he was evicted from his longtime home near Windsor Castle earlier this month. Police previously said they were assessing reports that Mountbatten Windsor sent trade information to Epstein, a wealthy investor and convicted sex offender, in 2010, when the former prince was Britain's special envoy for international trade. Correspondence between the two men was released by the U.S. Justice Department late last month, along with millions of pages of documents from the American investigation into Epstein. Excuse me. Following a thorough assessment, we have now opened an investigation into this allegation of misconduct in public office, Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said in a statement. Police searched Mountbatten Windsor's Sandringham home and his former residence at Royal Lodge in Windsor. Earlier in the day, pictures circulated online that appeared to show unmarked police cars at Wood Farm, Mountbatten Windsor's home at Sandringham, with plainclothes officers gathering outside. Excuse me. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing in his association with Epstein. The allegations being investigated Thursday are separate from those made by Virginia Giuffre, who claimed she has trafficked to Britain to have sex with the prince in 2001, when she was just 17. Giuffre died by suicide last year. Still, Giuffre's sister-in-law, Amanda Roberts, said that she was overjoyed when she got a phone call at 3 a.m. telling her the news of the arrest. But those feelings of elation were quickly complicated by the realization that she couldn't share the feelings of vindication with Giuffre. We can't tell her how much we love her, and that everything that she was doing is not in vain, Roberts added tearfully. Sky Roberts, Giuffre's brother, added that he thinks his sister would be celebrating the small victory along with them if she was still alive, but would be pushing for more accountability in both the United Kingdom and the United States based on the files. Joan?
And now for a Winter Olympics recap from Milan. On a night of American comebacks at the Milan Cortina Games, Alyssa Liu delivered the U.S. its first women's figure skating Olympic gold in 24 years. The 20-year-old Liu performed a near-flawless free skate Thursday to upstage Japanese rivals Kaori Sakamoto and Amy Nakai. She finished with a career best of 226.79 points. Nakai and Sakamoto each made a mistake on a combination sequence. Liu had walked away from the sport after the 2022 Beijing Games, only to launch a remarkable comeback. It was the first individual gold medal for an American woman figure skater since 2002, when Sarah Hughes won in Salt Lake City, and it was the second gold for Liu at these games. She helped the Americans win team gold. Sakamoto scored 224.9 points to earn a silver, and Nakai finished third with 219.16. Liu was third after the short program two nights earlier, though within range of gold. U.S. beats Canada in overtime for women's hockey gold. The U.S. women's hockey team delivered an Olympic comeback for the ages by beating Canada 2-1 in overtime to win the gold medal. With her team trailing 1-0, American captain Hillary Knight forced overtime by tipping in Layla Edwards' shot with 2.04 remaining in regulation. Megan Keller then scored at 4.07 into overtime to hand the U.S. its third Olympic gold medal in women's hockey. It was the seventh time the two powerhouses faced off for Olympic gold since women's hockey debuted at the 1998 Nagano Games. In 2022 Beijing final, Canada beat the Americans in the final. With the sides playing 3-on-3 in overtime, Keller broke up the left wing and pushed past Claire Thompson. Driving to the net, Keller got a backhander that beat Anne-Renée Debien. Kristen O'Neill scored a shorthanded goal for Canada in the second period. Earlier Thursday, Alina Muller scored the bronze medal winning goal in overtime as well, in Switzerland's 2-1 victory over Sweden. It came 12 years after Muller scored the clinching goal to deliver the Swiss their first Olympic medal in women's hockey, a bronze at the 2014 Sochi Games. Jordan Stolz stunned in 1500-meter. U.S. speed skater Jordan Stolz's late push wasn't enough. The American star settled for silver in the 1500 meters, missing a chance to secure a third gold medal at the Milan Cortina Games. China's Ning Zhong Yan won Thursday's race in an Olympic record time of 1 minute 41.98 seconds. The 21-year-old Stolz, who won gold medals in the 500 and 1,000 meters at these games, crossed a 0.77 seconds later. As Stolz glided by, hands on his knees, Ning raised his country's flag aloft with both hands and started a victory lap. Stolz, a Wisconsin native, will participate in the mass start on Saturday. Dutch skater Gerald Nuis, who won the 1500 at the past two Olympics, took bronze. Eileen Gu advances to half-pipe final, despite the fall. Defending Olympic champion Eileen Gu shook off a fall during her opening run to advance to Saturday's final in free ski half-pipe. The 22-year-old Gu was born in the U.S. and competes for China. She clipped the lip of the halfpipe on the third trick of her first run, knocking her left ski off and sending her skittering to the bottom of the course. That set up a pressure-packed second attempt that run earned 86.5 points, good enough to place fifth among the 12 skiers who advanced to the final.
Thanks, Joan. And now from the Bismarck page, Kowloon Coming to Revere Beach by Lance Reynolds. The Kowloon is set to turn Revere Beach into a tropical destination, with the legendary Chinese restaurant in Saugus receiving licenses to establish a tiki bar along America's first public shoreline. Kowloon Tiki Bar is slated to open at 21 Revere Beach Boulevard, featuring 175 seats, 115 inside, and 60 outside. DJs, live music, dancing, and of course, the eatery's iconic food items and drinks. It's going to be a family restaurant, manager John Carlino told the Revere Licensing Commission before the board approved his application. Lounge, a main bar area for families, good food, and great drinks. This is a tiki bar, and it's going to be an authentic tiki bar, he added. It's like you're in Hawaii and South Beach. Very nice vibe. Fun for families. We want families down there in the daytime. The tiki bar, tentatively, will be open 7 days a week, 11 a.m. to 2 a.m., Sunday through Saturday. Despite this late closing time, Carlino has promised that the establishment won't turn into a rowdy nightclub. Licensing commissioners expressed some concern about how the city has received noise complaints from previous businesses that operated out of the building where the Kowloon Tiki Bar will move into. The location also features some residential units. If there is a situation where we are starting to get a lot of neighbor complaints, Chairman Robert Selovich told Carlino, we'll probably be revisiting some of these things that you have put in place. I know a lot of people are excited about Kowloon coming to Revere Beach, the chairman added. City Councilor Jim Mercurio, whose district includes Revere Beach, strongly supports the business. He said he believes it will be a positive addition, bringing vibrance and economic activity to the beachfront. He added that a balanced approach is needed to support residents and other nearby businesses. Carlino said he was unaware of any issues with previous businesses. We'd have to be considerate of the residents who are going to be our customers, he said. Expanding to Revere Beach comes as the Kowloon's owners, the Wang family, intend to downsize the eatery's presence in Saugus from 1,200 seats to about 350. The property will feature two new residential buildings, each with a restaurant space on the first floor. The Kowloon, which celebrated its 75th anniversary last August, has already expanded to the Brook Casino, an entertainment venue in Seabrook, just a mile north of the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. Revere Police Lieutenant Glenn Malley warned Carlino that he expects the Kowloon Tiki Bar to be bustling with customers when it comes this summer. When something's new, you're going to be mobbed for the first couple of months, Malley said. So it's a good idea to have some control down there. Carlino responded, saying patrons can expect celebrities to appear often at the restaurant. It's going to be a destination, he added. And now, mortgages at a 3-year low. The average long-term U.S. mortgage rate slipped this week to its lowest level in more than 3 years, but remains up around 6% in the same narrow range it has been in this year. The benchmark 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate fell from 6.01%. I'm sorry, it fell to 6.01% from 6.09% last week. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac said Thursday, 1 year ago, the rate averaged 6.85%. The modest pullback brings the average rate to its lowest level since September 8, 2022, when it was 5.89%. That was the last time the average rate was below 6%. Mortgage rates have been trending lower for months, helping drive a pickup in home sales the last 4 months of 2025, but not enough to lift the housing market out of its slump dating back to 2022, when mortgage rates began to climb from pandemic-era lows. New data on contract signings suggests home sales could remain sluggish in the near term.
Joe? Moulton McGovern talks snap by Tim Dunn. Congressman Seth Moulton and Jim McGovern blasted President Trump on federal cuts to the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, during a press conference yesterday, as Massachusetts has seen a flurry of recent fraud schemes uncovered, and just days after the Herald published a whistleblower's account of rampant fraud in the program. Wages are not going up, and families are struggling more than ever. Hunger and food and security is getting worse in this country. And it's getting worse because we have a guy in the White House and leadership in Congress that is making it worse, McGovern said at the press conference. Nearly 100,000 people in this state are at risk of losing food assistance because this president and House Republicans passed this big, ugly bill. And when they did that, they stole nearly $200 billion, billion with a B, in food assistance, the largest cut to food assistance ever in American history. Moulton joined McGovern, making a short speech, also bashing Trump for the cuts to federal SNAP funding, before abruptly leaving the press conference early for an unknown reason. Before the event, Moulton's staff said he would be available for questions from the press. Jim mentioned that there are 40 million Americans who depend on food assistance. Let me share another number, $400 million. That's the cost of the new White House ballroom that Trump wants to build, because that's his priority as opposed to feeding American families, said Moulton. As long as Trump is in charge in the White House and his MAGA Republican enablers in the Congress do his bidding, a lot more families will starve. The press conference comes just days after the Herald detailed a whistleblower's account of rampant fraud in the state's SNAP EBT program and a lackluster response to combating fraud in the Department of Transitional Assistance, DTA. It also follows multiple SNAP and other public benefit fraud busts by the U.S. Attorney's Office and the State Auditor's Office. When asked by the Herald if Governor Maura Healey should turn over information on Massachusetts SNAP recipients to the Trump administration and USDA in order to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, McGovern said no. I wouldn't trust the Trump administration to tell me the correct time. And by the way, let me just say in terms of fraud, the SNAP program compared to other federal programs has a very low fraud rate. And the good news is that to the extent that there is fraud, it is being called out. I wish the Department of Defense had this kind of scrutiny, but it doesn't. Look, this is an important program, and already people in the Commonwealth and around the country are losing their benefits because of the new work requirements and the new red tape that were put in place. The governor continues to refuse to turn over the information, saying the administration has not assured her office the data will be turned over to ICE. When asked if the federal government should be subsidizing the fraud the state is not addressing, McGovern snapped back. claiming the feds are not subsidizing losses to fraud and SNAP program, going on to defend the efforts of Healey, state and federal lawmakers to combat SNAP fraud. Are you suggesting that $200 billion cut to a program that provides people an average of $2 per person per meal, that somewhere that's where they should go to find savings? Again, we have a hunger problem in this country, and we have, unfortunately, a hunger problem in Massachusetts that the governor and the state legislature and that our mayors and the federal delegation are trying to address, said McGovern. But please, don't tell me that SNAP is the poster child for fraud. That's just not the case.
It looks like we're coming to the end of our time with you this morning. If today is your birthday, here's your horoscope. Welcome to your year of the grapevine knot, when your hope holds because it commits. You grip tighter under load, never slip once set, and will not return to any shape you've already been. Ever forward, ever true. More highlights, fun, friends, finding and deepening love, doing the right work over and over until the wind falls, and a living arrangement that is so elegantly yours. Sagittarius and Pisces adore you. Your lucky numbers are 11, 23, 38, 7, and 29. Thank you for being with us, and have a fabulous Friday.